Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode of Sci-Fi on Screen. This week, we're going to be taking a look at Steven Spielberg's Jaws. Jaws is being covered under the notion that it is actually a horror movie, although it is kind of an adventure movie, but I'm sneaking it over the transom for Sci-Fi on Screen as a horror movie. Just a quick reminder, Sci-Fi on Screen's archived shows are available on www.scifionscreen.com, 99 cents a show. The latest six some odd shows will always be available free. So let's get to some background about Jaws. Richard Zanuck and David Brown, producers at Universal Pictures, independently heard about Benchley's novel Jaws. Brown came across it in the literature section of the lifestyle magazine Cosmopolitan, which was edited by his wife at the time, Helen Gurley Brown. There was a small card written by the magazine's book editor giving a detailed description of the plot, concluding with the comment, quote, might make a good movie, end quote. So the producers each read the book over the course of a single night and agreed the next morning that it was, quote, the most exciting thing that they have ever read, end quote. They wanted to jump on and get a film version going right away. So to direct, the producers first considered veteran filmmaker John Sturges, whose resume included another maritime adventure, The Old Man and the Sea, before offering the job to a guy named Dick Richards, whose directorial debut, The Culpeper Cattle Company, had come out the previous year. However, they grew irritated by Richard's habit of describing the shark as a whale and soon dropped him from the project. So meanwhile, Spielberg, who discovered the manuscript, I think in someone's office, like some random office, he saw it somewhere and read it. And as soon as he read it, he realized that it was very much like Duel, which he had just made a couple of years ago, in that, you know, this kind of Leviathan hunting this guy in the form of a driver of a semi-truck. So for himself, he realized that it was a continuation of themes that he was really good at, and he wanted to jump on it right away. So after Dick Richards was kind of let go, the producers talked to Spielberg. He had just done Sugarland Express about a year before they were discussing it. I guess the producers liked the film, so they signed him. So for the screen adaptation, Spielberg wanted to stay with the novel's basic plot, and he wanted to omit a lot of the subplots. One of these, if you read the novel, Hooper has an affair with Ellen Brody. This is a little affair because Chief Brody and her are not getting on that well, and so it gets a little complicated. Spielberg, of course, wanted to keep it very simple. He declared that his favorite part of the book was the shark hunt on the last 120 pages, so he wanted to change a lot of it. So when the producers purchased the rights to the novel, they promised Benchley that he could write the first draft. Overall, I think Benchley wrote three drafts before he turned the script over to the producers and to Spielberg, basically saying, hey, I'm written out on this. This is kind of like the best I can do. You guys take it from here. And Benchley would later describe his contribution to the finished film as the storyline and the ocean stuff, basically kind of the underlying mechanics. He found Tony and Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Howard Sackler, who was in Los Angeles when the filmmakers began to look for another writer, and he offered to do an uncredited rewrite. And since they were pretty unhappy with Benchley's and Spielberg's own drafts, they all agreed, and Sackler wrote himself a draft. Spielberg also wanted some levity in Jaws, humor that would avoid making it a dark sea hunt, which pulls this film out of a pure horror movie. It's really kind of a horror action-adventure movie, really, because, first of all, John Williams' music in a lot of it, and a lot of the comedy, and that the horror isn't really so grim and brutal consistently, you know. So Spielberg turned to his friend Carl Gottlieb, a comedy writer, actor, then working on a sitcom, The Odd Couple, and he sent Gottlieb the script, asking what he would change, and Gottlieb sent Spielberg three pages of notes, and then Spielberg offered him a part in the film sort of to keep him close and paid while he, you know, so he could be on set and do rewrites as needed, and he played the part of Meadows, the politically connected editor of the local paper. So the other people contributed. Again, Spielberg wrote some stuff. Scheider ad-libbed, "You're going to need a bigger boat." John Milius contributed some dialogue polishes, most notably in the Indianapolis speech by Robert Shaw. I think Shaw even did a little work on that as well. And at the end of the day, Spielberg estimates that 27 scenes in the movie were not actually in the book. So definitely decent enough changes were made that Jaws the movie really is its own thing. So for casting, Spielberg complied with a request from the producers to cast known actors, although he wanted to avoid big stars because he felt that more anonymous performances would help the audience believe that it was happening to sort of every man. The first actors cast were Ellen Brody, Lorraine Gary, and Murray Hamilton as the mayor of Amity Island. Stuntwoman turned actress Susan Baclini was cast as Christine, who's the first victim in the beginning of the film, as she knew how to swim and was willing to perform nude. Most of the minor roles were played by residents of Martha's Vineyard, where a lot of the film was shot. So the role of Brody was initially offered to Robert Duvall, but Duvall wanted to play Quint. Heston expressed a desire for the role, but Spielberg felt that Heston was too big a persona for the part of a lowly police chief of a modest community. So that's perfect, actually, you know. "You're going to need a bigger boot." You know, Heston would have been too big for anyone playing Quint, right? So Scheider became interested after overhearing Spielberg talk about the story at a party about a shark jumping into the back of a transom of a boat. And so then he kind of walked over to the group at whatever party they were at, and they were chit-chatting, asked Spielberg to talk about more of the film. And at some point, Scheider says, "I'd like to be in this." And Spielberg kind of looked at him and was like, "Why not?" And boom, he kind of was cast soon after. 9 days before the start of production, neither Quint nor Hooper had been cast. So Quint was originally offered to Lee Marvin and Sterling Hayden, both of whom passed. The producers had just finished working with Robert Shaw on The Sting and suggested him to Spielberg. Shaw was very reluctant to take the role since he didn't like the book, being a writer himself. But he did accept at the urging of both his wife and actress Mary Ewer and his secretary. Quote, he says, "The last time they were enthusiastic was from Russia with Love, and they were right," end quote. So Shaw actually based his performance on fellow cast member Craig Kingsbury, a local fisherman, who I think at the moment we see him on the dock when Hooper shows up as Ben Gardner. Spielberg was saying that there was a long shot that if he couldn't find a Quint, that he might have cast this guy, this local fisherman, actually, as Quint instead of Ben Gardner. But so for Hooper, Spielberg originally wanted John Voight, who passed. Timothy Bottoms, and Joel Grey, and Jeff Bridges were considered. Lucas suggested Richard Dreyfuss, as he had used Dreyfuss in American Graffiti. And Dreyfuss passed initially, and then went to see a press release screening of the film he had just made called The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz. And he said he watched himself up on screen and thought he gave the worst performance that anyone had ever given in a movie and panicked, freaked out, and then said, "I better get another job before, you know, this film gets out and no one wants to hire me." So he called Spielberg back and said, "If Hooper isn't taken, I'd be happy to accept the role." And of course, he was given the part. A little bit about the music, of course. Such a huge part of this film is the music. John Williams composed the film's score, obviously, which earned him an Academy Award and was later ranked the sixth greatest score by the AFI. The main shark theme, a simple alternating pattern of two notes, which was an E and an F, became a classic period piece of suspense music synonymous with approaching danger. I mean, this is probably up there with the Psycho music of Bernard Herrmann. Spielberg later said that without Williams' score, the film would have been only half as successful. I feel as that is true, not only with this film, but I think with Star Wars as well. Something that him and Lucas brought back. Because at the time, if you remember in the 70s, the jazz and rock scores were the thing. Like, you know, music films mostly were using sort of electric music and electric combo, you know, scores supplemented with strings. So, you know, a lot of 70s movies, you hear a lot of drums and funk backbeats. I feel like Spielberg and Lucas brought back the full-on orchestral scores. I have to believe that you pull Williams' music out of Star Wars and you put in some half-assed attempts at doing anything, and it's a lesser film. And I think Jaws is the same thing. I think especially the scenes in between, the horrific scenes on the high seas when they're like on the hunt for the shark, Williams' music, man, is like the most so rousing in it. You know, besides the two-note thing that he did for when the shark actually attacks. So incredibly important film music. And for me, Spielberg, in my mind, being such a descendant of Hitchcock, for Bernard Herrmann and Hitchcock, too, in certain films, very similar. So I feel like he definitely picked this up But him and Lucas were very, very savvy, I think, recognizing how powerful music can be in any film. Okay, so let's jump in, no pun intended, to Jaws. So we open the film with an underwater camera work and our classic dun-dun-dun-dun theme playing very, you know, a little gently. And then we're right away at a beach party, and we're with this young boy and girl who just met. The girl's name is Chrissy. We hear later. We never know the boy's name. They get together. She runs for the beach, discarding her clothes as she goes, and runs into the water. The boy following her is so wasted that he can't kind of bring himself to go swim. And then we're very quiet as she's out in this beautiful moonlit scene, the full moon, so you can see pretty well in the water. He's waiting on the shore, and then we start the camera from the sort of underwater shark point of view. In a sense, it made me think of, not unlike John Carpenter would do with Halloween, when you're at the from the killer's point of view, that there are times in this film when you're from the shark's point of view. And I always wonder, was it something subconscious that added to his notions of things, or did he very consciously? Because I don't think I've ever heard Carp talk about Jaws. So I don't know. It just made me think of that. So we get the attack right away. She bobs down, then is moved around, and she starts to scream. And then the gurgling scream sounds were made by, I don't know if it was the same actress or someone else, sitting in a chair, and Spielberg pouring like a water down a woman's throat, and the woman screaming through the water on the Foley stage, which is this separate stage where all of the sound effects are recorded and then added later. Very rarely are you hearing the sounds when you're seeing a film shot. If you don't know this, most of everything you hear, from a door opening to like the creak of leather, it's all added later. Almost nothing is really taken from the original shot with the microphones that are used, because of just bleedage and other sounds in the world, and how unperfect the recording is. Almost, 90% of the stuff is added later. So yeah, so Spielberg poured water down this woman's throat and had her scream to get the sounds that he wanted. But in this shark attack, what struck me is that Spielberg keeps the camera fixed, and on the corner of the screen, you're anchored to the scene because the corner of the screen is a buoy, and the buoy doesn't move, and so the camera stays the same, and you see the buoy on the left side of the screen, and she moves back and forth under some power that we cannot see under the waves, and it's pretty startling. And when I was watching it for the podcast, I thought, wow, in modern movies, you would have had 1,000 jump cuts. The camera would have been all over the place. You know, it would have been sort of like a blurry of cuts of like water and blood and shark, and you wouldn't have been able to sense anything except that there's an attack going on. And yet, he keeps the camera stationary in one spot and moves the girl and does no cutting. And it's very effective, and it's kind of startling and frightening because she's screaming and in panic. Like the woman playing Chrissy is very good. And at the same time, you get a sense to see just how weird it is to see a human body moved around the water in this way from something that we can't see. So right away, to me, and I think this movie is, in terms of Spielberg with the camera, one of the greatest things he's ever done, and where he puts the camera and all the creative things he does with the actual camera placement and how he blocks and stages the scenes is so great. He's just like this crazy young kid who is so full of ideas and energy, and man, it's like on every frame of the movie. And this is the beginning of it, and it's really great to watch. And what's great is after she finally goes down for the final time, and the camera still stays stationary, we hear the ding ding, we hear the sounds of the buoy in the background, and we're back to the placid water, unbroken, with the moon shining, and it's very relaxed. So we've had like, the scene has been started quiet, built to a frenzy, and then tailed off and got back quiet again, which to me, it's like, I don't know, it's like music or speech or good writing. Like, it built, climaxed, and then ended. Whereas I feel like in a modern movie, you would have, it would have been cuts to death, and then you would have just cut away from it to something else without having time to breathe. And just these subtle little moments in this film, to me, is part of what makes it such a masterpiece. And then we finally cut, and it's the next day, and we're at the Brody residence, and Chief Brody and his wife are getting out of bed. The script in this film was written by, so many folks, and honed down and sanded down to perfection, really. And it's the soul of economy. One of the first lines is when Brody gets up, he says, "The sun didn't used to shine in the bedroom." And Ellen says, "Well, we bought the house in the fall." So one line, and what do we know? We know that the Brodies are new to the island. This is their first season. What brought them there? Like one line that's given us so much information to kind of set this up. So I really appreciated that as well. So then there's this great shot in the kitchen. And to me, Spielberg's early style had a little bit of 70s kind of Robert Altman in it, because we have this shot where they're in the kitchen. His wife, Ellen, and I think it's Michael, one of his children, are in the background, and they're chit-chatting. His hand is bleeding from something that happened, and she's dealing with it. And we could kind of hear their conversation. And then in the very extreme foreground to the screen right is Brody on the phone, and we're hearing his side of the conversation, which will turn out to be, you know, the call that gets him to go out down to the beach to find the first victim. And this, you know, the dialogue is overlapping. It's very 70s, and it happens a couple of other times in this film where there are scenes that I haven't seen in a lot of Spielberg films in the late 80s and 90s and the rest of his career, where screenwriting has become very, it's very precious now, like when things are said and how things are said. If there's talking over one another, it's usually so stylized that you can see it coming a mile away, except for, you know, some films that still will do it wonderfully naturalistically. But this is great, and I wonder if this was kind of Howard Sackler, the playwright, doing this, or, you know, who knows. But I really like it. It really grounds the film early on in kind of a dramatic realism that will be continued throughout most of the film, which prevents Jaws from becoming an overblown blockbuster. To me, often the first films in either genres or franchises that, you know, are the kickoff films aren't themselves bloated, overstuffed blockbusters. They're usually hybrid films where, in a sense, they're half of a shape of what's to come after them, and the other half is actually really good dramatics that are maybe reserved for kind of solid dramatic movies. And then later on, the solid dramatics and realism will be stripped away, and other stuff will be stuffed in to make the bloated sequels that usually come movie after movie. You know, and I think Raiders is one of them, the first Raiders of the Lost Ark movie, you know, Star Wars, although I think George kept a lot of it for Empire. But, you know, the first movies are like, they try to be real movies. I think at this time in cinema history, we were at this place where this new kind of blockbuster filmmaking was about to happen. But the films that started it were attempting to be very dramatically sound movies with good characters and dialogue. And they happen to have these great concepts in action, which to me makes them, you know, like Alien, still seminal great films in their respective franchises, because they tried to be complete films, whereas the children of these films did not try to be complete films. They wanted to exploit what was perceived as the big selling points of these movies and push those elements and strip out all the stuff that is a lot harder to do, which, you know, they didn't have time or the interest for, frankly. So anyway, I wanted to mention that because there's a lot of it in Jaws. There's a lot of, like, just a solid dramatic movie. Like, strip away the shark, and there are little elements here that could be in Ordinary People, you know, and Kramer versus Kramer. So, and I think it keeps Jaws the classic that it is, and you're able to go back and watch it over and over again, I think, for these reasons, as well as the wonderful moments with the shark and so on and so forth. Anyway, he gets the call to go out and deal with this issue, and as he pulls away, a very economic shot, we see Amity Police Department on the side of his truck. And as he's driving away, Ellen says, "Okay, Chief." You know, so all these little subtle moments of like who he is and where he is and what he does are all done very economically within the script itself. It's really neat. Now we get to the beach, and Brody's walking with this boy who Chrissy was with last night, reporting her missing. And we get to the first kind of horrific moment after the opening, and we see her hand sitting amidst, you know, a group of crabs which is crawling all around it. And Spielberg said that originally they weren't going to have the crabs, but that the hand that they fashioned looked too fake. And, you know, some experts that were connected with the film said, well, you know, actually a human hand sitting in the sun for a couple of days would look like a fake hand. And Spielberg was like, even though that might be true, I'd rather it look like a real hand for the sake of the realism I'm trying to create with the movie, which I think is fascinating, frankly. So what they did was they buried a person. They buried a person's arm in the sand, and that hand you're seeing is actually connected to a real person, and the crabs are real. So anyway, it's a great scene. They don't linger on it too much, but the movement of the crabs to me is the scene. I think the hand is great, but it's the crabs moving all around it, nibbling at it, that are incredible. So back to his office, the camera's behind him and shooting to as he's typing. You know, when he gets to the little box in the form, he types in shark attack because he got an initial call from the coroner saying that, in the coroner's opinion, that this also was a shark attack, which will be reversed later when the mayor applies some political pressure. Now, he's finished with his report, and he gets up and he walks through town, and it's a great scene-setting moment for us. He walks through, and we see that it's this, you know, this kind of summer Long Island town. We're getting lots of shots of people walking around, people going to the beach, just the sense of what the town is like. All the locals kind of know him now, and they're coming up to him and complaining, and he's having to deal with the complaints. He goes into a local hardware store, buys some boards and some brushes and some paints, and when he comes out, his lieutenant kind of drives by. He's told that there are Boy Scouts doing stuff for their merit badges in the bay, and he gives his lieutenant sort of the materials to make the no swimming signs and then heads off. What happens here is wonderful in that the mayor and the mayor's kind of cronies follow Brody to the car ferry. So there's this wonderful, wonderful shot. Brody gets on the ferry, and he asks the ferrymaster to bring him closer to, you know, the Boy Scouts who are, you know, earning their merit badges, and we see them in the distance doing their thing with their scoutmaster nearby. Essentially, the conflict now begins between the mayor and Brody, and the mayor gets out. The medical examiner is there, and he says, well, you know, I was in haste. Really, it wasn't a shark attack. We're thinking it might be a boating accident, and Brody starts to get the sense of what's happening here. And the beauty of this scene is that, like he did with the shark attack, he doesn't cut back and forth like a two-shot. There's the mayor, and there's Brody, there's the mayor and Brody. The camera stays on the corner of the ferry, but the ferry's moving. So you get the camera, you get Brody in the camera, the mayor is facing Brody, and the ferry is now turning and moving. And so you're seeing what makes the scene dynamic is two things. Number one, you're seeing the background change as the ferry moves. So it's completely organic without having to create all this motion. You've got a background moving because the ferry is moving, but the camera is stationary. And then as the conversation between Brody and the mayor intensifies, they get closer to the camera until at the very end, you know, we have this wonderful line. It's like, you yell barracuda, people say what? You yell shark, and you've got a panic on our hands on the 4th of July. You know, bang, and you're right in front of the camera in the foreground there. And so it's just an astonishing, again, it's a young man with a camera, man. He's like, and I don't mean to be ageist at all, but, you know, he was young and just out of the box and, you know, brimming with ideas. I mean, there are movies I've seen of him actually has gotten older where he still has this incredible energy. He's brimming with directorial ideas of how to stage things. And you can see it. And it's conscious enough that if you're looking for it, you're going to see all the places that he does it. And it's really great. So I really love this sequence. So now we have the first shark attack scene. And so we're on the beach on the ocean side, seemingly much later. Brody and his wife are at the beach with a bunch of friends. And, you know, they're chit-chattering on in the background. And Brody's just sitting there in a chair watching the ocean. And we have the beginning of this Kittner family, which is an older woman and her young son. And the boy sheepishly asks his mom to go back in the water, and she says yes. So we start with the camera on the boy, and as he goes to get the raft that he's going to float on, the camera follows him. He walks by Brody, and the kid continues off frame, and then the camera stays on Brody. Just a wonderfully economic little shot. So now we're cutting back and forth between the people out swimming and Brody watching them and freaking out. And what I didn't realize the first time I saw it was that they do these screen wipes, but they do it when people walk in front of the camera, they cut. So, you know, there's a shot of the camera. If you watch the scene, there's a shot of the camera looking at Brody, and then you see a blur as someone actually on the beach walks in front of the camera. But when they've passed by, you've cut to the camera facing out looking at the ocean. And then when someone walks in front of the camera in this direction, you cut back again to Brody. And it's so seamless that you don't even notice it. Like, I had to have it brought to my attention by watching some background materials for the film. But it's a really clever little thing. So we see a dog is going in. His owner is throwing a stick. And, you know, that's going to not turn out so well as we will get to. There's a false scare as Brody leans up and he sees this dark sort of figure under the water moving towards the kid, and then the figure pops up and it's this old man. There's a second false scare as this guy is now complaining to Brody and is blocking his view of the ocean, and he's kind of trying to get around and look past the guy as the guy's saying, hey, you got to, you know, the people are leaving trash in front of my door. And he hears a girl scream and he gets up only to find her on the shoulders of some person in the water. So, you know, false scare number two. This is kind of a funny scene. The old man that he mistook for the shark in the first false scare now comes up. Hey, chief, you know, hey, it's kind of weird that, you know, you don't like the water. The old guy's wearing a bathing cap. Brody looks at him. He's like, that's some bad hat, Harry. And the guy gets pissed and he leaves. And I believe Bryan Singer, I think it's Bryan Singer, called his production company Bad Hat Harry Productions. So I think if you see any X-Men movies or anything that Singer is connected with, I believe it comes from that line from this film, which is kind of clever. So then we begin with the tension. We see the owner of the dog is calling for the dog. Dog is nowhere to be found. We see the stick that the dog was supposed to get bobbing up on the water. Then Williams' score starts to kick in where the camera is underwater and we see legs. And then there's this great early astonishing scene where the camera really rams into the Kidner boy. And then the camera cuts back if we're on shore. And from a distance, we see this massive creature immediately kind of come up and roll over and take the boy with it. And it's done so quickly and so unobtrusively. It's like in the corner of the screen. We're not really sure what we saw, and then it's over. And then we see people getting up on the beach who were looking out, who were like, did you see that? What was that? So everyone notices that something has happened. Then we see tons of blood fountaining up around this poor boy's raft. The boy is taken down. Now everyone is screaming and running out of the water. And then the heartbreaker of the scene is when everyone's out of the water, the boy's mother walks towards the water by herself. She's the one going the other direction. And the broken raft that he was on slowly washes up into shore. No Alex. And, you know, it's a brutal scene. Spielberg, you know, for all the times where he's sentimental, you know, he really messes with kids. And, you know, he just killed a kid in his movie. I don't know that would be done in modern films. I don't think you could get away with killing an innocent boy in some ways. I think you'd have to kill some horrible person that you will have made to dislike, you know, like a bunch of teenagers out on the water and some asshole boyfriend who's like being mean to his girlfriend or drunk or something would have to get killed. So we as the audience member wouldn't get too upset, right? And I think this is pre all of that kind of corporate calculation that has to get done. It's a pretty messed up scene. And later on, when she comes to slap Brody in the face, you know, we as the audience member kind of get a sense that it really wasn't his fault. He was out politicized by the mayor, but there's enough wiggle room in there that we get a sense that maybe Brody didn't fight hard enough and this poor boy is dead. So, you know, but again, this is good dramatic writing, you know, really good stuff. So really great scene, but very tough to see this little kid get killed. So now we get the first town hall meeting of the mother of the boy who died is putting out this bounty for $3,000 to whoever kills the shark that killed the boy. Brody announces that the beaches are going to be closed to everyone who's interested, but the mayor chimes in only for 24 hours, which we see Brody's been taken by surprise and undercut. I didn't agree to that. So then we have this great moment with Quint, the classic moment where he's drawn a shark on a chalkboard at the back of the room eating a person, and he's now dragging his fingernails on the chalkboard. And even watching the film, you're like, oh, it's such an incredible, irritating sound. And here we are with Quint, the great Robert Shaw. And he has this great line, find him for three, I'll catch him and kill him for 10. For that, you get the fish, the head, the whole damn thing. And he has this great, one of two great monologues in this film. You know, the second is to come, but it's a great introduction to him as a character. No decision is made. Now we're with Brody and Ellen at home, and Brody is kind of reeling about the boy dying, and he's reading about sharks, and we're reading the book with him. The camera is taking a look at all of these pictures of people with shark bites and shark injuries, so some realism is being brought into the scene about, you know, these things that really happen, which is great. Then we get this fun scene, which is very Spielbergian. These two older guys. Reminded me of the scene that Roland Emmerich basically stole for a Godzilla. These two sort of townies get this huge pot roast and they stick a big hook in it and they throw it in the water and tie the line to the pier, and they're just, you know, they're hanging out waiting, and the shark grabs it and it takes it and the entire pier gets blasted out and is pulled away. And we see a section of the pier heading out to sea, and one of the guys who was on the pier when it went out is now in the water swimming for sure. And then the great scene, and Spielberg says this is what he left it in the movie, is when we see the chunk of the pier that's floating start to turn, and we realize that the shark is now turned around and is heading back for the lone man swimming, and his buddy is having him swim. So a lot of tension. He makes it. A lot of close-up camera shots of him slipping on the wood, getting out of the water, and then the piece of the pier that was chasing him slowly comes in and beaches, and so he's safe. We've had a near miss. So it's daybreak now. It's pandemonium at Amity Island, as every Yahoo in the town, and she's been We find out that Mrs. Kittner has been advertising in out-of-town papers as well. So all this crazy pandemonium is happening at the docks. Everyone's drunk and with guns and dynamite. And you know, Brody's running around trying to stop people and getting his deputy to try to stop people. Like, it's, and he's overwhelmed. We could see it. We see some brief scenes out in the water. People are chumming way too much, and they're chumming in each other's wakes. And it's just, you know, it's a really great moment for us. We just recognize, like, oh, this is gone so wrong, you know. So during all this, we meet Matt Hooper, played by Richard Dreyfuss. And he and Brody quickly go to the medical examiner because he has heard about this attack and he wants to confirm the medical examiner's ID that it was a boat. And we have a great, which was done to much greater effect in The Silence of the Lambs, sort of the post-mortem, as he's there with a little recording device. And Dreyfuss is fantastic here. And you know what? The movie that he went to see of himself that freaked him out, I would love to see, because he's such a wonderful actor. And he's so great here. He's very magnetic in his delivery of the dialogue. And he does something that Pacino does time to time. The rhythm of the dialogue is kind of a little off, where he's in the middle of saying something and Brody lights a cigarette and he's like, the thoracic nerve was severed. Do not smoke in here. You know, like putting that all together and making this wonderful monologue, very realistic feeling, you know, really great. And we see him react. And I think this is a credit to Dreyfuss. We see him react with nausea and disgust as he's looking at what's left of this poor girl that, you know, this is no boating accident. This is a shark, a large shark, and you have a problem on your hands. And, you know, he looks at the medical examiner as like, you know, do you have any shred of dignity that you're going to call this a boating accident? So we get this escalation now.
Don't tell me they don't use money in the 23rd century.
Well, we don't.
Would that day were here, but alas, it has not happened yet. I just want to take a minute to let you guys know how you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. One way is to support me via Patreon. And Patreon is a great site where you sign up and decide how much you'd like to support per podcast. And you can set it as low as like a dollar a show. And you only contribute when I publish a podcast, which is, I think, a great way for people to support their favorite shows. If you'd like to do just a one-time donation to the show, you can find us at PayPal at scifionscreen@gmail.com. Always encourage you guys to retweet my shows on Twitter, share them on your Facebook page, throw up a review on iTunes if you like. And again, to remind you that all of my archive shows that you don't see for free are available for 99 cents a show on my website. There's an easy-to-access archive page where I have them all alphabetical by film, so you can just go and click on which one you like. And they're 99 cents a show. You can get as many as you like or as little as you like and enjoy my archive. I've got about 2 years worth of shows, about maybe 90 shows backlogged there.
Tell them, Jim.
Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim.
Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim. Tell them, Jim.
We cut to a brief time later. A larger than average great white has been caught by, you know, one group of boaters. It's brought back on the docks. It's pretty large, maybe a third of what our shark will be later on. Hooper is great. He's measuring the bite radius, and he's like, it might be the shark, but he very much doubts it. There's an arrow sticking out of it, which is kind of funny. And there's a whole photo op. The mayor is there, very happy that this has been shot. Hooper's telling Brody, you know, the only way that we can be sure is to cut open the belly of the shark, and if the boy is still in there and the dog and all these other things that it's eaten, it's a very slow digestive cycle. We'll see it, and we'll know. And the mayor, of course, does not want it done right then. He doesn't want to see the Kittner boy flopping out onto the deck half-eaten. And then we get this really tough scene, which I was kind of hinting to earlier. Mrs. Kittner, who lost her boy, comes. She's dressed all in black, and she walks up to Brody, and it's like, I just found out that you knew that a young girl was attacked and killed the day before my boy died, and you knew about it. You knew, and you didn't close the beaches, and she slaps him. I just wanted you to know that. Like, it's a tough scene, you know, really good scene. Because, you know, now we have, great for Brody's character, right? Now he has this guilt that it's his fault. And, he takes it on as a great protagonist in a film will or a book will do. We, the audience, know that he's not entirely complicit in this. Really, the mayor is the one who kind of overruled him. But in that moment, the situation was so atypical that it wasn't in him to make a huge stink. and go to the mats and say, oh, you have to close the beaches. This is crazy. And if he had done that, you know, the boy would have been saved. So there's enough wiggle room in here where we recognize that his character is going to take this on. He's going to take on the guilt of it. So great moment, tough moment. Then later, back at his house, he's getting drunk. He won't speak. And there's this great moment where he's sitting at the table drinking, and his young son, this is a classic scene that everybody's seen. His young son is sitting there mimicking him, and he's opening his hands and closing his hands, and the son's doing the same, and then he fakes him out, and it's a beautiful scene. We see Ellen off to the side watching it. J.J. Abrams cites this scene as one of his favorite things ever, and it's a beautiful scene. And he leans over, and he's like, give us a kiss, and he said, why? Because I need it, you know? Just wonderful Roy Scheider giving our chief, our hero, some, you know, a little pathos. Like, he's really taking this on as his own. Hooper arrives, brings a couple of bottles of wine. There's a weird moment of Hooper's character where the dinner that Brody was too disgusted to eat, he pulls it. Is anyone eating this? And he pulls the food over and starts eating it. He watches Brody pour a really good wine into a, you know, water glass, whatever. So a little bit of a exposition here about Hooper's theory about a rogue shark swimming outside of a pack that will stay amongst a food source until it has been, you know, basically decimated and eaten out before moving on. So we're getting a sense of that it's not over, and that, in fact, unless they actually do the scary thing, which is go find and kill the shark, it's not going anywhere. So then, as he's drunk, you know, he realizes they can go down to where the shark is hanging and cut it open, and they do. And it's another great Spielberg moment. It's shot in a slightly interesting way where the camera is looking at the shark, and then just beyond it is Hooper, and then beyond that to the right is Brody. So Hooper's making motions underneath the shark as if he's cutting it open. And it's all about Dreyfuss's skill as an actor, that, and also the special effect of the sort of liquid that starts to that we start to see flow out from under the shark, and Dreyfuss's reaction and his speech patterns change as he starts to smell the guts of it. That we believe he's cutting into the belly of the shark, but we never see it. And then, you know, we cut away later and we see him throwing a license plate at Brody, which is a great thing, and that it's coming up, the shark has come up through the south, and we see a Louisiana license plate that it has eaten, and a boot or some other items. But basically, by the end of it, they realize that it's not their shark. But it's just shot in a very clever way. So now there's a night scene where Hooper thinks that the shark's feeding in a certain area of water, and he wants to go out at night on his super fancy boat to try to find it. He drags Brody out with him, and we get a little bit of character development with Hooper, that he's really rich, and that this is just what he loves to do, you know, as he's just a rich dude, but he loves, you know, the water and oceanography, and this is kind of what he does. So kind of get a sense of him a bit. They come upon Ben Gardner's boat, which has been sunk. Hooper goes in diving to check the hull, and there's a great tension here because, you know, he's in the water at night, and we see this massive tooth stuck in a hole on the side of Ben Gardner's boat. And of course, at that moment, Ben Gardner's face comes popping out and freaks Hooper the hell out. It's a great horror movie scare as well. And Hooper freaks out so much he goes to the surface, but we see the tooth, which would have proven the point that Gardner's boat was taken down by a shark, disappear into the ground. So that's going to, the loss of that tooth will be the setup for what's going to happen the following day, and have, you know, the big scene where another person is killed before the mayor has the stones to go along with Brody. Then there's a big argument with the mayor that day. Great line from Dreyfuss, you know, you're going to ignore this problem until it comes up and bites you on the ass. The mayor refuses to close the beaches. He doesn't have any proof. This is where he goes at Hooper and says, where's that tooth that you said you found? Do you have it? No, I lost it. So this brings us to the big set piece, really, the 4th of July. And we start out by seeing all these boats, these ferries coming to Amity Island, bringing all these people, hundreds of people. And there's a very jaunty John Williams theme playing, like making kind of like, oh, this is very fun. Everyone's at the island having a great time, you know, a great music cue per what is to come. So Brody's now out on the beach. There are spotters. Hooper's out in the water with a bunch of spotters. There's helicopters. Basically, since they can't convince the mayor to close the beaches, they're doing a full court press, but no one's going in the water. They're all hunting for the shark. They don't see anything. And there's wonderful chaos and tension. There's all kinds of boats out there, guys with, you know, homemade guns and revolvers looking for the shark. But then the one creepy moment where the mayor really shows his stripes, that nobody's going in the water. So he walks up to this elderly couple with their grandchildren, and he's like, no one's going in. Please go in the water. And they're scared shitless. and they slowly walk in the water all holding hands, you know, and it's really like, you know, great tension. And we're scared along with them. But as soon as they get in, it has the effect that the mayor hoped it would, and everyone else now goes in, and now we're on a full-on summer scene. Everyone's in the water. Brody, afraid for his son, won't allow him to sail his new boat out in the ocean, but he asks him to put it in the pond, which is this little bay not far from the beach, where he reasons that, you know, an ocean-going shark isn't going to go in what they call the pond. Then we have our first false scare. There's suddenly a fin very close to where all the bathers are. Everybody freaks out, and there's this mass exodus toward shore. Lots of children in jeopardy, as Spielberg loves to do. You know, kids are screaming, and parents trying to find their kids. The kids alone screaming. It turns out to be a prank, and it's a great couple of shots. First, we're shooting in the water, and we see the fin roll over, and two kids pop up, and then we switch to their point of view, and there's like three guys with rifles, like about to shoot the two kids. Then we cut back to them, and the one's like, "He made me do it." Until we realize that it's a prank. But right at that moment, we see going towards the pond now, this large dorsal and tail fin suddenly go underwater. And this lone girl by herself points and sees it. And she's like, you know, he picked the right girl. And he picked the, you know, he coached her that her, at first her reaction is not very convincing. She's like, shark, you know. And we, the audience, are like, "Would you yell, please?" And she doesn't, you know. The Brody child and his friends on this boat, there's a guy on like a Boston Whaler nearby sort of instructing them on how to sail, and he's knocked out of his boat and pulled beneath the waves by the shark. And the next thing we see, this astonishing shot, his leg, which has been severed from his body. First we see a sneaker and a leg, and then, you know, you expect to see the body, right? And it's the end of the leg, which has been sheared off like at the thigh, and it's really creepy. And back on the surface, we see a bloom of blood underneath the boat. And then, you know, the camera is going towards the boys, and we're scared to death because it's Brody's kid, but they all make it out alive. But Brody's son goes into shock. He has to bring him to the hospital. And at the hospital, the mayor is there, and the mayor is like already into, he's talking to himself in like an ass kissing, ass saving kind of way, like, "I just wanted to help the town. That's the way I'm going to say it. I wanted to help the town." And Brody just like, he's like, "You're going to sign this. And it's a voucher to hire Quint to kill the shark." And he has to ask him like three times and press him. But, you know, it's great in the sense of the writing style is that Brody's own child was almost killed. And so, you know, how could the mayor say no to him? And then there's one moment where the mayor's like, "You know, my own children were on the beach that same day, Brody." So he's, you know, there's a little moment of where the mayor's not a complete asshole. We just recognize that he's a little myopic, but that his own children were also on the beach and may have also been in the water. Which I like, you know, making it all very human. After a brief mano a mano getting to know each other at Quint's shack, the hunt is on, and the camera shoots Quint's boat, the Orca, leaving dock through the jaws of one of the sharks that Quint has killed years ago, hanging in his workshop. You know, great foreshadowing. So there, we're out on the boat with our three heroes. The first scene that I like as we go is the Quint Hooper, where Quint's chugging a beer and he crushes the can in one hand, and Hooper is chugging water or juice or something and crushes a paper cup in one hand. Very funny. We get a great scripted telltale in that Brody, being kind of the rookie on board, doesn't really know a lot about boats, hates the water, pulls a wrong knot, and Hooper had brought on board all these oxygen tanks and the shark tank that he's bringing on board, much to Quint's hilarity and disdain. And at one point, Brody pulls the rope. One of the tanks roll across the deck, and Hooper flips out and is like, "Martin, you got to be careful about this stuff. These could blow up, right?" And of course, these could blow up. So that's going to be the end of the movie. How do we know that these can blow up? You're telling us right now. So very clever. It happens quickly. It's connected to Brody's newness on a boat. He doesn't know what the hell he's doing. So great, great, simple thing. Then a great subtle moment of tension. They're all chit-chatting away, and the line that's out with bait on it clicks over very subtly. Very subtly. And we hear Hooper and Brody talking sort of off-screen. But on-screen, we're close up on the reel, and Quint. And Quint eyeballs it, and it clicks over again. It clicks over again, realizing that something's nosing around with the bait, thinking about taking it. Quint looks in the water, and we see a little jigger of the line in the water. And if you've ever been fishing, you know that's the moment when you're on tenterhooks waiting for this the fish to take the bait. So there's this great quiet moment where we follow Quint slowly eases into his fighting chair. He puts on his leather fighting harness. He clicks it to the reel. And all the while, click, 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 click. And at the same time, and everyone's, you know, they're fairly quiet, actually. They're chit-chatting away. But it's fairly quiet on the boat. Brody's trying to tie a knot that, you know, Quint's teaching him basic seamanship. He's trying to tie a knot. He fails. And as soon as Quint gets in the harness, Brody yells, "I got it!" You know, and he pulls the knot. And at that moment, you know, I guess we're led to think that the sound triggered the fish to panic and go away. The line gets taken, and off we go. So immediately, very adventurous, the fish is taking the line out, and then suddenly it's quickly slackened. This is the beginning of the camera starting to show us Quint spooked by the behavior of the shark, because he's been, you know, we've seen back at his shack, he's got like dozen upon dozen boiled shark jaws, right? So he's caught all kinds of sharks in all different scenarios, but the behavior of the shark spooks him from the beginning. And there's a little John Williams music cue also, which lets us know that Quint's a little freaked out by what's going on. That not only has the shark taken the bait, but he's turned immediately around and got onto the boat. And he's sort of reeling in all this line that's too easy. And Quint's like, it's too easy. And then the line snaps. There's this moment between Quint and Hooper where Hooper's like, "You don't have it. You snagged on the bottom. It's nothing." And Quint pulls up the metal and he can tell that it's been bitten through by teeth. And there's a little great moment between Quint and Hooper where he says to Hooper, "You know, with all your fancy schooling, you haven't learned to admit when you're wrong," right? And it's good. It's like Quint's being honest about it, you know. Hooper kind of hates the fact that he's just been kind of shamed, honestly, by Quint. And while Quint's back's turned, Dreyfuss makes all these funny faces as he's wont to do in the movies he was in back then. And very funny. And a light moment after kind of a tense one. Now we get to sort of the beginnings of the intensity of things, where Brody's chumming off the back of the boat. It's such a great, I mean, everyone, you know, if you've seen this movie, you know this scene. And he's not looking, and he's not looking, and he's not looking, and he chums, and he turns around, and there's the fish, like, boom, right out of the water, massive in the screen, looks so real. Then Spielberg does this great thing where once we see the shark, we cut to the camera shooting as if the camera was just off the back of the boat, looking up and towards the boat, and Brody snaps into the frame. So it's the frame of the back of the boat, and then, you know, Brody sort of steps up into the side, and this incredible movement in one movement. I mean, they must have did it 100 times till they got it right, but it's really effective because he goes from motion to stop, and then we see the look on his face. It's just complete paralysis. It's a great shot. And then he backs away slowly. And then we're in the cabin with Quint and we see Brody backing in and we're going to need a bigger boat, which was ad-libbed by Roy Scheider. And now we get the reveal of the shark for real. So the music swells and now the fish in brazen challenge is revealing itself to the crew, and it's swimming right near the surface so they can all see it. And this is great. Cooper first reaction, you know, blown away by a 20-footer, and Quint, 25, swims right by the boat. We get a sense of how massively big it is, 25 feet long, and Quint says under his breath, 3 tons of them to pull up, you know, so 3 tons, imagine fishing and pulling something out for 3 tons. And now the John Williams music goes into like adventure mode, and so we're into high adventure here. Hooper is flipping out. He's grabbing his camera, trying to take photographs. Quint goes into the cabin and pulls out a little case where he's got his harpoon gun, and he starts snapping it together. And it's great because now Spielberg does this great thing where most of the shots now, when they're in full battle with the fish, is low angle, meaning they're low, the camera's sort of low to the waterline and shooting up. And so we get so many shots of the men moving around the ship and looking out and their reactions from a low angle. And there's something very epic about it. It's almost like, you know, the last part of Jaws is like the last part of The Road Warrior. Like there's something epic about those low angle shots where most people are silhouetted against the sky. It's just a great epic sense of things here, which make this hunt really, really something to behold. So now a great tension scene is the shark is circling back and heading straight for the boat. Quint has his harpoon gun ready to roll, but Hooper hasn't attached the line to the barrel yet. And so there's Hooper, hurry up, you know, and finally when the shark gets close, Hooper finally finishes. There's the harpoon into the side of the fish, and Quint has his first barrel in. Nothing much happens after this first encounter. Darkness now comes in. Now we have this great, you know, before we go into hardcore adventure, afterwards we get our last bit of character building with all these guys. And it's a really great scene. And again, more of why I think that they do good drama. Like, I think this would be cut out of modern films, that you have the first encounter with the shark, and now they're taking a little breather, and the men are coming together and having this character moment inside the cabin. So the first thing we get, which is very clever, is the comparing of scars back and forth between Quint and Hooper, because Hooper's been around sharks his whole life. First, Quint starts with pulling a tooth out, you know, this cap that he can pop on and off, and smiles. Then Hooper shows him a scar on his arm from a moray eel. Then a scar on his leg from a bull shark. Then Quint shows him something from a thresher shark. So back and forth, and they're bonding and they're drinking. Then there's a last lighthearted moment before the intense moment where Hooper pulls open his shirt and he's like, points to his chest, and he's like, Mary Ellen Moffat, like 12th grade or something, she broke my heart. It's a big laugh. And then Hooper notices that Quint has had a tattoo removed. And as soon as he says the USS Indianapolis, you can see the tone of both the guys drop, because Hooper knows what it's about and Chief doesn't. And then you get this four-minute monologue from Robert Shaw about his experience in the water with the Indianapolis, which is just astonishing. Go to YouTube and just type in Jaws Indianapolis monologue and just watch it. It's a bunch of people have it up in really good quality. I was going to play just some of it on the podcast, but you know what? You got to do the whole thing, and it's 4 minutes long, and I think it's a bit long of a break between commentary, so I didn't want to do it, but it's brilliant. And it goes from this, the joshing camaraderie of the guys, to this brutal story. True story, actually. They pulled this true story, and everyone's claiming it, right? Like, I don't know if it was in the novel, so I have to see if Benchley's part of it, but John Milius did part of it. Shaw ad-libbed some of it. I think this guy Gottlieb wrote some of it. So everybody had a hand in shaping this, but oh my God, Robert Shaw is mad. This is like the best thing I've ever seen him do. It's an amazing 4 minutes of screen time, and you are hypnotized by this guy. So I highly, if you haven't seen Jaws in a while, go back and go to YouTube and Google this. It's amazing. And again, this is a real movie. You know, and here's a character who's going to die. Like, you grow to really be blown away by Quint. You know, in a weird way, this is like a hero's monologue in a sense. But it's not Brody. It's Quint giving this incredible monologue, and he's going to die very soon. So there's the realism of this film. Again, you know, from the shark and from the adventure, we're right back to these are real men. The story of what a massive shark attack was like, the biggest in history. We're dialed into realism. It really did happen, you know? So just a great way to, you know, you're making a real movie about things that matter, as well as an adventure movie. You know, it's two things at the same time, not just a blown up blockbuster. There's a real movie in here as well. So at the end of it, in order to lighten things up, they hear a whale sound, which interrupts at the end of the story, because there's no real place to go when a story like this ends except cutting away to something, and they really can't cut anywhere. So they hear a whale, and then they start singing together. Show me the way to go home. And as they're singing, we see the barrel that was, you know, approached the boat. Now the shark starts ramming the boat from under the water, and we see the planks being pushed in and water coming in and flooding it. It's incredible. And dawn is close now, so it's not so dark outside. Quint grabs a rifle and he's firing into the water. You know, it's totally taken them by surprise. Then we cut to daybreak. It's quiet again. Quint and Hooper are in the bilge, actually working on the engine itself, while Brody's keeping watch. We see a barrel come up floating, and they bring in the rope and the barrel, and the shark broaches right there, opens his mouth. Again, another great shot. You never see too much of the shark. You see just enough to get a sense of it, and at times later in the film to scare the crap out of you and be like startled by it, and then it's gone. So at one point, Brody realizes Quint's not going to, what he said, he's not going to get a bigger boat. He's got some kind of personal vendetta here that he wants to ram home, and Brody picks up the CB radio, which we've seen Quint use earlier when Brody's wife called to check in, and he basically told her everything's fine. And at that moment, it was their first glimpse of the shark. So as Brody's trying to use it, Quint comes in and grabs a bat and smashes the crap out of the radio, and Brody screams at him and flips out. No way to call for help. They're not going in. It's on. So they chase now. The shark starts to go away. They're chasing it, and they get a second barrel in. And they tie one of these lines to the back of the transom of the boat, and the shark starts pulling the boat backwards. Of course, they can't get the ropes off in time, so they're kind of stuck, and Quint's afraid the shark's going to pull the transom off the boat. And finally, he takes a machete and cuts the lines. And there are three barrels in the shark now, and it goes down. And, you see Quint, like, three barrels in him. No way he stays down for long. And down he goes, and then Hooper comes close, and he's like, Quint, have you ever had one of these do this before? And Quint is now really spooked, and he shakes his head. And now Quint is pretty much freaked out. He goes up to the flying bridge and puts the engine in, like, overdrive, and he's like, we're heading in for home. And you hear him talking to himself, you know, like, we'll bring him into the shallows. We'll drown him there. And so they're going in at, like, half speed, which they would probably have made it. But Quint's so afraid now of the shark that he floors it. And Hooper's yelling up at him, the engine's not going to take it. And we see the shark chasing the boat, basically. You know, they are in pursuit. And at some point, the engine does blow out. You see this black smoke coming out, and he blows the engine. And you see sparks and a lot of smoke. The engine is fried, and the bilge is almost full of water. So they are in trouble. So now it's a very sober part of the movie. The three of them are looking at each other, and Quint asks Hooper, you know, what are these fancy chemicals you got? And Hooper says, if I could, you know, get these chemicals into the shark, I could probably kill it. But he can't get it through the hide. The shark skin is too tough, so we would have to go in the shark cage. And when the shark got close enough with its mouth open, jab it inside and kill it. So, you know, we do this whole tension moment where they put Hooper in the cage. And I like that there's no, you know, there's no blockbuster action movie dialogue here. It's very matter of fact. There's no parting words like, give him head, Mr. Hooper, or, you know, whatever. It's just very workmanlike. They put him in the cage, and the only thing you see is Hooper's like, I can't even spit to put in his mask because he's so bloody scared. And they close it, and down he goes. It's just great. Again, you know, not super heightened. And these days, that would be a moment for someone who was doing a rewrite of a script to, like, put in a pithy line, like some either funny line or interesting line, but it would be a line and you would know it. Whereas in this film, just the workmanlike sense of them getting him ready and putting him under is so much more chilling than having us step out and have a line about it, which kind of makes us think, oh, I feel a little less worried and we're in an action movie, you know? So it's just, again, very subtle, but very good. So then we have the great moment of him in the tank. And some of the films you see of the shark on top of the cage was footage that they had this guy shoot. Originally, they were going to try to have a little person in a tank and have a shark maybe a third of the size of what they had the Jaws shark be. So you really do see, when you see the shark threshing on top of the cage, it's one of the few shots in the film of real sharks really going crazy. But before that, basically, it's coming in and coming at Hooper, and it smashes the cage to pieces. And right at the first moment, he's holding the lance outside of the cage, and the first shock he gets is the fish comes from behind, blasts him, and the spear with the chemicals drops to the floor of the ocean, so they're kind of screwed. So immediately he's screwed, but he doesn't die. I think he dies in the book. I think Benchley kills him. But here we see him swim down to the bottom of the ocean and find cover amongst some rocks. And just wait. So on top, Brody and Quint pull up the cage, and it's empty and destroyed, and they realize that they think, obviously, that Hooper's dead. And then we have this moment where the shark actually rises up hugely and smashes out the back of the transom of the boat completely. And there it is, writhing, this huge mouth in the back of the boat, tipping the boat back towards it. And Quint right away slips and falls, and there's a brief moment where, you know, Brody tries to grab him, but he slips and falls right into the mouth. And we get some pretty full shots of the action as the shark chomps down on Quint's legs and him screaming and there's blood everywhere. And then at one point, we can tell after he's been threshed around a few times that he is quite dead. And he's pulled down and gone. And all we see is this kind of blood in the water. And it's pretty brutal scene. And so now we have Brody's last moment. The orca is sinking fast. The shark is then trying to enter through the windows. Brody's kind of stabbing at it. At this point, he throws one of the oxygen tanks into its mouth. The rule of three, the first time was he almost blew it up. The second time, he's taken it and thrown it into the mouth of the shark. And then so it backs back out with the tank in its mouth. And then basically, it's listing and dropping in the water. And he grabs a rifle and a harpoon and gets up on the highest mast he can as it's dropping lower into the water. And then, of course, the wonderful last moment as it's slowly swimming towards him, and he's basically doomed and trying to hit the tank And he's missing and he's missing and he's missing. And Smile, you son of a bitch. Boom. Hits it. Blows the shark completely to pieces. Chunks. And then there's a great shot under the water of the body of the shark with the head missing, just listing down, you know, gushing blood. And he's quite dead. So then Hooper pops up, you know, and they have this brief moment where the two of them just look at each other and laugh. And Hooper says, Quint. And, you know, Brody shakes his head. They rig up this little thing with two barrels and a plank and basically swim towards shore. And there's a brief parting moment of them just having small talk. And we are out. So, not much to sum up here. I've said most of what I want to say about the film during the commentary. It's my favorite Steven Spielberg film, hands down. Just continuously, year over year, when I go back to watch it, it still stands as my favorite. It's a perfect little movie. The script is perfect. The direction is inspired and interesting and so inventive. The acting is spot on. The script is very economical. You know, you go and you watch documentaries about him and how difficult it was to make, and the shark wouldn't work, and everything was breaking down, and they were rushed for time and all this crazy stuff. And what came out of it was this masterpiece film. And the fact that I think they wanted to feature the shark much more in the movie, but because it never got to work properly, he was forced to kind of be oblique about it. But I think this is something that he's adopted in his style now. You know, you see other things, especially like War of the Worlds. Like, he does so much stuff with things off camera and building the suspense, kind of like Hitchcock in a way did. You know, it's not what you see, it's what you don't see, and what you're led to fear is going to come. And he's adopted that style in all of his movies that I've seen. You know, that less is more in terms of saturating the screen, sort of the anti-Michael Bay, as it were, where Bay will fill up the screen with 1,000 things constantly until you know, he has bludgeoned you to death and you know, pick yourself up and slink out of the theater. Spielberg's completely different. And I think he, you know, really started with this film, whether it was a style that he consciously created or it was one that was thrust upon him because of circumstances. Either way, I think he learned quite well what works for him. It's just a magnificent movie. There were a bunch of sequels. Jaws 2, Roy Scheider came back, and most of it took place on catamaran sailboats. Jaws 3D they did, and then Jaws the Revenge, and none of the sequels. The second movie is watchable as a really kind of lame B-movie. None of the folks who directed any of the subsequent films had any idea, really, what magic he was able to conjure up for this first one. They're really workmanlike kind of monster shark films that you might as well watch Sharknado instead, right? And none of them even come close. There was a knockoff film a couple of years later called The Orca, which was about an actual, you know, killer whale with Richard Harris, I believe, which was not very good. But this still stands head and shoulders above pretty much anything similar in terms of at sea sharks and adventure movies in that modern sense. So just an amazing film. That's pretty much all I have to say about it. If you like the show and you'd like to hear more, I've got 5 or 6 free, usually up on any mobile device or on my website. And then my entire archive of about 90 other shows are on my website, www.scifionscreen, 99 cents a show. I've got a handy page called Index of Podcasts by Film Title. You head on over there, click on the movie you like, takes you to the page, 99 cents, boom, you're ready to go. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.